Welcome, everybody, to another program in Season 4 of Food Conversations. Before we begin, of course, we acknowledge that we're living and working on the ancestral and unceded and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepik people, and that fairly resolving this situation, and I would add, addressing the issues of the marginalization of Indigenous people that's gone on for centuries, is an ongoing responsibility for us all. So today, we're not going to go international, we're going to go hyper-local. We're going to have a guest on the show who's one of our favorite guests, and she's in the studio with me today, Sue Moore, the owner of Sadoa Farm, and until 2020, the owner for a quarter of a century of Notch Hill Organic Farm and Nursery, and as well, someone who is a regular fixture, of course, at the Sorrento Farmers Market. Sue, welcome back, as always, to our capacious and well-appointed studio.
Thank you, Warren.
I look around and all I see is boxes everywhere, but when we get our storage area completed, it will all look very, very spruced up and smart. Sue, we've had you on the show a number of times, and what you bring to the show is some really solid practical information about what plants do and what we can do with them and for them. And so today, we did have a little chat beforehand about all the things we might talk about. And we started off by talking about the fact that it's Christmas, and maybe Christmas has a relationship to the vegetable world and the plant world and the growing of things. What do you think are some interesting ideas that we could lay out for our listeners with respect to Christmas gifts that would be relative to gardening?
Ooh, well, one of the things I always think about is how can we practically keep people involved in the garden or get our younger folk involved in the garden? And so you don't have to go out and spend a fortune on stock or indoor plants or whatever. Mm-hmm. You can give a gift certificate.
Yes.
Like a personal gift certificate. Like, I will build my 67-year-old, slightly disabled neighbor a beautiful box to grow in so she can continue growing her greens and doesn't have to get down on her knees.
That's a wonderful idea.
Yeah.
I have a visual, and it looks, I see creaking knees, not creaking.
or maybe you could make a little cold frame so that your kids could start their radishes and things that grow very quickly early in the spring.
One of the things we also talked about was, with reference to children, was something that children always like, which is books. Well, in most families that I know, they do. And I did a little research on books for children because there's quite a few of them. There's a wonderful website that PBS in the States, the public broadcasting mm-hmm. system, puts out. They call it Best Gardening Books for Kids. But the one that really caught my fancy, it's entitled Growing Vegetable Soup. And it's designed for very young kids. It says 0 to 4, which I don't think means the fetus, but it does mean young children. And it's all about how you focus growing activities around the food that you're going to be eating, and you have the children see all the phases of the food being prepared. As a teaching garden, you see kids up there, and you must see them, their eyes light up as they wander around the garden and see that things are growing under their very nose.
We do see kids up there a lot, and there are some programs that actually bring children, fairly young children, into the garden. And we do plan activities for those children, things like planting peas or picking peas or, that kind of activity. It's hard to keep them interested for a great length of time, and it's hard to keep their little feet off of some of the other products. But
yes, it does not do well underfoot.
Yeah, but it's exciting to see the children there. That's not my main area at the teaching garden, but I love to see them there.
I remember when we were talking earlier in another show about your beginnings in the garden with your father, sort of a little bit more like work and a little bit more like, it wasn't, maybe there's ways to make food really interesting and growing it really interesting for kids that your father, rest his soul, might learn about.
Well, I mean, my main memory is being allowed to use his big knife. And to set slug traps and yes, my mother was horrified, but I remember that very clearly, and it is a useful task, perhaps not one that, you know, most 4-year-olds would.
We all have our place. We all have our place. So let's talk a little bit about soil. Now, of course, soil, when it's under snow, you can't do a lot with it, but. Things like preparing amendments and figuring out which ones you might use. Why don't you just name a few of the things that you think are really helpful for amending soil, particularly in this area, which has certain soil characteristics, this part of the world. What do you think people should be thinking about or stocking up on or preparing for when the...
There's not really a huge amount you can do right now, but the main thing to do, I think, is if you had a garden last year, is to assess your garden.
Okay.
And for instance, if you had a crop that was being chewed up by a certain bug, you should, you know, make sure that this year you don't plant the same crop in that area. So you should do a crop rotation of some kind. If you had a crop, for instance, if you grew a whole load of one of these wonderful crops like kale and then found that 90% of your family wouldn't eat it, you know, it's like what am I going to grow this year? Did I have enough tomatoes? How did the carrots do? Why didn't the carrots grow? Mm-hmm. And just think about it and learn how to do a little better in this upcoming year.
One soil amendment that we're accumulating all through the winter is compost.
Absolutely.
Why don't you wax gloriously a little bit on compost? I think it's emerging as the number one champion soil amendment.
Well, if you have a composter and you're working on compost, you should have closed it off by now from your last year's compost, and you should be starting another one, because if you're adding compost to a soil, it's nice to have a nice well rotted compost. If you have a very small garden and you don't have room for a composter, one of the things that I have done is you make a trench in your garden and you just put your scraps into that trench. And then in the spring, you cover that trench up, and that's where you would plant your broad beans, your peas, your beans, your product
the legume family,
something that doesn't need a lot of nitrogen from the soil, because the compost steals nitrogen to decompose.
Of course.
So that way you have a beautiful soil forming in your garden, and you're also adding extra nitrogen with the nodes from your legumes, and so the following year you would put something that is pretty hungry for the nitrogen into that space.
What about wood chips? I have a neighbor who is very fond of wood chips as a sort of soil amendment, because it's a lot of clay and it sort of loosens up the soil. Obviously there's a timing pattern with wood chips.
Yes. I think the smaller you can get your wood chip, the better.
Of course.
There's some wood chips to stay away from, like you wouldn't chip up cedar or black walnut and put it into your ground.
Yes, because cedar and black walnut are used by humans to knock off things that they don't want in their bodies. So I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, but you have to understand that the wood chip is also taking nitrogen to break down. And probably in 5 to 7 years, according to the size of your wood chip, it will start giving that nitrogen back.
Hmm.
But in the short term, like the first 5 to 7 years, yes, you have to make sure that you amend your soil with some nitrogen.
You can tell that both of us are over 5 or 7 years old in this room today. And so is Tom, my engineer. He's confessed that he's over 7 as well. Christmas gifts. Have you got any other ideas for something like starting microgreens in your own home, that kind of thing, like a package of seeds that you could turn into greens or something of that nature?
Yeah. Microgreens is something that people are really into these days, and I really think that it's great because it adds to your nutrition during the months when greens are incredibly expensive. All you basically need for small microgreens would be a fluorescent shop light.
Mm-hmm.
And
a grow light, or whatever they call it.
A grow light if you're going to grow them a little bit bigger.
Okay.
Because once they start growing, then they need that extra spectrum. But if you're just going to grow them to inch and a half tall, you can have just a fluorescent light fairly low down on them, and they'll grow. You can clip them, and one of the things to avoid is getting them too wet.
Really?
Because in the house you don't have the ventilation. So if you find that you're growing some microgreens and they're getting a little bit of mold, the thing to do is to put a fan on them.
Okay, to keep the air moving.
To keep the air moving. But, you know, like if you don't have room to do your microgreens, the least you can do is sprouts.
Sure.
And sprouts, So a sprouting kit, a microgreens kit. Microgreen seed, if your people already have their kits. And you can grow anything, really, for microgreens. You don't have to go to microgreens. Pea tips are premium. I love pea shoots. Yeah. And you can do that as microgreens.
For the flavor.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. You can also do them as sprouts.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
The indoor garden could be augmented easily. Just remind listeners that I'm talking today with Sue Moore, who has been farming and sprouting and raising new plants all over the Shoe Swap for now. I guess it's 25 years on the farm. And how many years since you... It was 2020, I think, that you sold the farm.
Yeah. So 2 years in my new location.
Yeah.
And I had a farm in the Fraser Valley for 12 years before that. So
you did. Yeah. And I'm sure there's many people who patted their tummies and said, that was a very good meal from the food you were growing. My wife's always telling me that I should plan our garden more carefully. And from what I'm hearing you say, it's obviously something that is like learning from your garden so that next year you have a better, you've adjusted what you're doing and what you're growing.
Absolutely. It's, I mean, on the farm, it was both more complicated and a lot easier as well, because you were dealing with a much larger area. Also on the farm, you had to take water into consideration. There's no way you would want to be, have your big overhead irrigation going on your onions just after you've pulled them to dry, etc. So, you know, you had to think about these things. So a home garden is a little easier than that. But you do have to think about rotation for disease and for sun. And sometimes you just cannot rotate as well as you would like to. So you have to be really on top of things like disease.
Watching what's coming out of the ground and paying attention.
Yeah. And also supplementing the soil a little bit more. Like crop rotation takes care of a great deal of your soil nutrients. If you can't rotate, things then like, you have to take care of that.
You're talking about things like cover crops and that kind of thing.
I'm talking about cover crops and putting in beans and peas and, you know, following that with a high grower.
So let's talk a little bit about some of these basic ingredients. We've talked a little bit about soil and compost. What about sun and positioning crops or plants of whatever sort that you're growing so that they get the sun they need, not too much, not too little? Talk about some of the intricacies of sun exposure for plants.
Well, I mean, if you've got a large open garden, then you don't have to worry so much about plants needing sun. Most of your plants will get lots of sun. The problem then is that possibly you would want to plant some in the shade of your larger plants so that they don't get quite as much sun. For instance, lettuce. It doesn't really require as much sun. Peas certainly don't require as much sun, and some of the other crops. But it's more important to have plants in the sun than out of the sun, I find.
Yes, yes. I had 4 kale plants in a row, and one was shaded by a large rose bush, and it was about a foot and a half shorter than the other ones. So it was telling me something. What about water? I mean, watering, there's so many different ways that people water their gardens. Sometimes they water them, as you said, it can be too much. Sometimes it's too little. And there's different ways to water. You mentioned briefly the sort of circular overhead spraying system, which is, I think, is a little tricky because a lot of water evaporates if the temperature gets up to a certain point and the sun is shining. So why don't you talk a little bit about water and irrigation in general?
Well, I don't like anything on an automatic watering system. That's one of the no-nos of vegetable gardening as far as I'm concerned.
It rained for 2 days and 2 nights, and we watered all the way through.
So that can cause some issues. I like a drip system. For a small garden, you can set up a drip system, and you can even set it up so that you have a little spigot on each line.
Hmm.
So that you know, like if you have a row of onions that you're drying, then you turn that off. If you have something that requires a lot of water, you turn it on. If it's really, really dry and you're, you know, starting your seeds off, you might want to put an overhead sprinkler on early in the morning.
Yes.
Just until the seeds have germinated, and then go to your drip system.
A lot of plants, when you're propagating them or growing them, they say when they're at the very early stage or they're just seeds in the ground, that's when you really have to be very careful that the ground doesn't dry out.
Correct.
Even plants that don't like much water when they get bigger. That's pretty much a golden rule, is it not?
I think so. There's very, very little that's going to suffer from being in a damp ground.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, if the ground is totally waterlogged, you're going to your beans and especially are going to rot in the ground and things like that. And too heavy a water from overhead will pound your ground down, your soil down.
Compact it.
It'll compact it. And it doesn't have those little airways in the soil. And roots need those airways. And your myceliums and other funguses and things. And that's why we like to see worms in the garden, because the worms recreate those airways once the rain has taken them away.
Why don't you say a few words about funguses in the soil? It's something that's emerged from obscurity, certainly in industrial society. We now recognize that fungi are under the surface doing all sorts of wonderful things. Compost is a marvelous source of fungal elements. Why don't you just rhapsodize a little bit about fungus?
Well, it's an area that I really don't know a super huge amount about. It's something that I haven't particularly researched. I do recall one of my workers pulling beets, and they had mycelium fungi on the roots, and she threw them all in the compost because she thought they were rotting.
she knew even less than we do.
She knew even less than we do. So you know, like, just because you have something white and fungal looking on your root, that is probably really good. And the fungus, they help to transmit the nutrients to the soil, from the soil to the plants. Without knowing exactly what they are and what they do, I would say that 99% of them are really good for the soil.
I'm thinking of the work of Suzanne Simard, who showed that deciduous trees transmit up to 15 or 20% of nitrogen to conifers. And one of the practices in forestry has been to cut down or brush all the deciduous trees out of forest areas. And now it turns out that was a very bad idea. Not the first time we've fallen on our faces. Now, you said that as you look through your garden from last year and what worked and what didn't work, then you you think what you're going to do next year and you plan relative to what you learned. Are there any strains that you have found? Well, we'll go through individual plants in a while, but perhaps we could talk about it from the point of view of catalogs, because catalogs, plant seed catalogs, have a ton of information, and they describe pretty well everything that's there is wonderful. It's just that some are more wonderful for certain situations than others. Are there catalogs that you find yourself going back to again and again that that contain the sort of information that you find is helpful?
Oh, certainly. That's one of my favorite hobbies, is browsing catalogs in the winter. You just sit down in front of the fire. Nice cup of tea. Or something stronger.
And a little rum in your tea then.
You just sit there with your catalog. I like to browse a huge variety of catalogs, but I find myself coming back time and time again to William Dam catalog. It's a family owned business who have sold untreated seed since their conception, which must have been, I don't know, 50 years or more ago.
My goodness, that's quite an achievement, 50 years ago.
So when everyone else was turning to treated seed, they refused to go that route, so they have my seal of approval, let's put it that way. There are other seed companies. There's West Coast Seeds has a very informative catalog.
I've seen it, yes.
As a commercial flower grower, I like going to Stokes. They have a commercial flower growers catalog. Mm. Baker Creek is a company that most people don't know about. They have a catalog that looks like an encyclopedia.
That's maybe why people don't. They think they're intimidated.
It's fabulous color photographs. And to go for Baker Creek, you'd probably have to look on the internet. Their catalog is not readily available, and you probably have to pay for it. But they collect rare and unusual seeds throughout the world.
My goodness.
And they have some very, very different seeds in their catalog. Baker Creek is in the States. Johnny's seed catalog.
Johnny's
down in the States. Okay. is really focused on the small commercial grower, and they often have introductory vegetables, and they have a number of vegetables that you can't get in any other catalogs.
Really? Is that because they have special characteristics that lend themselves to more large scale growing?
No, it's mainly that they have focused a lot on organic and small growers. And when a vegetable goes off of the market, because it's not premium for commercial growing. Their customers will often rebel. And one of the things I can think about is a leek, the King Richard leek.
Okay.
It's a fabulous leek. It's a summer leek. It doesn't hold very well on the table. It's not really suitable for huge commercial farmers, but it's very fast growing, has a beautiful white shaft on it, and it's just a fabulous leek.
I think we can say on this show that there is a leek that is fabulous, and it will be understood by our listeners. Once again, I'll remind listeners that I'm speaking with Sue Moore, owner of Sadoa Farm, and really a goldmine of information on the vegetable kingdom and many parts of the fruit kingdom as well, and somebody who's played a major role in teaching local budding farmers and gardeners in their own backyards about things they can do to enhance their own lives with plants.
Well, thanks, Warren.
You're most welcome, and I think our listeners would probably echo my remarks as well.
Can I just add a little bit about the catalogs?
Add a lot if you need to.
Okay. One of the things that I'm really excited about is the net. Because
yes.
The smaller growers, the smaller seed growers, people like Sunshine Seeds in Kelowna and Annapolis Seeds in Nova Scotia, they have wonderful catalogs. But they don't have paper catalogs. Or if they do have paper catalogs, they're very plain, boring, because they can't afford the big glossy catalogs of the huge companies.
But that would seem to me to be moving in the direction that all of us are really thinking we should move, which is to stop cutting down a lot of trees and sending. I mean, I love paper documents and books, but by the same token, if we proliferate all sorts of published material in paper form, it's going to mean a lot of trees coming down pretty quickly. But there is a sort of democratizing influence of the internet. It allows a small grower, a small catalog producer, to have as much impact as the largest of the large catalog producers, simply because there's the material side by side and you can make a direct comparison in the privacy of your own computer.
And if you want to research seed companies, you just Google, you know, Canadian seed companies or BC seed companies or whatever you're actually looking for.
And they all come up.
And they all come up, yeah.
Just like the things we plant in the early spring, we hope.
We hope.
We hope indeed. Speaking of which, you told me an interesting story about a gent who's his growing area is quite high in altitude, and he uses peat moss in an unusual way.
Oh, yes. That's in the spring, especially if you have heavy snow late in the spring and you're itching to get out on your garden, one of the things you can do is to get a bale of peat moss or some black soil if you have it, even compost, it's whatever, and you just scatter it lightly over the top of your snow. And the
sun. It absorbs heat.
Yeah, it will develop heat, and that part of your garden will
using Mother Nature's qualities to help yourself. Now, an extension of catalogs, of course, is somebody like yourself presenting ideas to the community about things to grow and ways to grow them. You've been involved in the teaching garden and also doing some workshops. Why don't you talk a little bit about that? Because I think people would like to know that you're around and you're doing stuff like this to help them out.
Well, yes, the workshops are ongoing. There's Sunday workshops happening.
Is at Buckerfields.
It's at Buckerfields, and this week I believe it was on fermenting foods, and I believe next Sunday is going to be on sourdough bread making. So, yes, and in the spring, look for workshops on starting your plants, your early garden. We've done workshops at the garden, to tour the garden and check out the successes and the issues. We have a permaculture garden just starting there. That El Marie
at the teaching
is,
garden.
Yes, that El Marie is focusing on, and we do workshops on seed saving and various other things.
What do you notice when you have people out on the land looking at what's growing, as opposed to a class or a workshop? What's the difference like for you to be there with them, pointing to the stuff growing in the ground, that kind of thing?
Well, even at the workshops, we try and do something practical. We try and get people to actually start some seeds at the workshop or something like that. Going around, I find that people really observe, and that they'll, you know, you'll be talking about how to save seeds from this carrot plant, which is growing these beautiful umbels. And they'll say, well, that plant there looks as if it's going to seed as well. What's that one? And how do we save seeds from that one? And is this marigold dry enough to take from seeds? And just to get people excited about saving their own seeds, the process of gardening is you need the soil, you need the water, you need the sun, and all of those, if you're fortunate enough to have your own land or have a friend who's going to lend you some, is there for you. With the seeds, I remember my dad always buying seed. And it is such, if there's no seed available one year,
what
are we going to do? So to know how to grow your own seed, even if you never do, I think is really valuable information.
It's kind of like having an insurance policy on your house.
It is, and it's really it's kind of exciting. You're walking downtown in Samanam and you're seeing somebody surreptitiously taking seeds from some of the the plants that are growing in the hedgerows.
Mother Nature just put them out there to tempt people.
Exactly.
Which is a wonderful thing. She knows it's like birds that eat seeds and then poop them out 1,000 kilometers away. They're not thinking about transporting seeds, but they do.
They get their little spot of fertilizer with them as well.
Perfect combination. Little compost right off the bat. Let's talk about something a little different, and that is the use of greenhouses. Some people around here are really moving forward in that direction. Obviously, it extends growing seasons or creates a growing season where there was none before. What's the role of greenhouses, say, for a gardener who's got a small area of land in their backyard that they'd like to grow some things, and they're wondering if they should put a greenhouse in, and what would it do if they did?
Quite often the greenhouses that you put up in your backyard are really too small to do any winter growing in. The cost of putting up a really good quality greenhouse is fairly high. I put up a really cheap greenhouse, and I've taken the plastic skin off of it so that the snow won't destroy it over the winter. We'll put it on again in the spring. Mm-hmm. So in many ways, I have a greenhouse, but I use it basically as a cold frame. And it's very good to move some of the plants that need a little bit of warmth to grow in. You move them out into it to harden them off. It's part of the hardening off process. Sure. You can start your greens and lettuces and actually grow them in the greenhouse. And you get a earlier crop from them because the temperature doesn't fluctuate quite as much. It's very good to keep your tomatoes covered because tomatoes will suffer in this area and many others from blight.
Okay.
And blight is caused by overhead watering, and unfortunately the rain does that.
It does come from the sky.
Mm-hmm. So if we can keep overhead watering off of our tomatoes, we have a much greater chance of getting a really good tomato crop.
So greenhouses are sort of a bit of a specialty, and you have to kind of adapt them to the particular conditions, either the particular plants you're trying to grow or the location you have, or that kind of thing.
Yeah. If you're lucky enough to have a really good greenhouse with a heating system that you can afford to run these days, you can grow some absolutely beautiful plants early in the spring.
Now, we talked about growing indoors, which is sort of the ultimate greenhouse is your home. Where and how do you start your seeds indoors? Because I've driven to your place and seen a carpet of seedlings everywhere. I've never seen an asphalt driveway that had so many plants growing on it. Mind you, they were only temporarily there.
I have a little shed inside. I have a little heater, one of the oil coil type heaters, which I plug in underneath a bench, which gives me a heated bench.
Sure.
I have shop lights that give enough light to start the plants really small. And they can grow to a certain size with that. And then after that, they would go outside or into my unheated cold frame to harden off. What I find I'm missing in my system is a heated area with either windows or specific grow lights to bring the plants up a little larger before they go out. And that's what I really miss. I had that at the farm, but I don't have it here in my
home.
In the big city, and I'm having to learn it to cope with that. So because of that, I start my seeds just a little bit later.
So when is the favored time to get seeds into the ground and starting to grow?
I've put seeds in as early as March. So I'm just thinking in March, as soon as you can get onto the ground and start working it, and you can tell if it's too wet, you just pick up a handful of soil and you squeeze it. And then you toss it up in the air and you hit it. And if it stays in a ball, it's too wet. And if it falls naturally all over the place, sure, you can go in and start planting your seeds.
Well, that is an eminently practical suggestion, Sue. I can see citizens all over Salmon Arm going out to their garden right now, digging through the snow. They won't be doing that.
No. You have to
have
wait for the snow
exposed.
To go. Yeah, it has
exposed
to be exposed.
Soil,
and then you, if you're careful, you can plant things like turnip. Some of your mustard greens, your arugula, grows very well in the cold soil. Probably if you have some butter lettuce plants, butter lettuce tolerates a cold soil. And some of the early beets, the early wonder tall top, will tolerate a cold soil. Your peas. And in this area, you need to get your broad beans in as early as possible.
How early would that be?
Well, down on the coast, we used to plant them in October.
Mm.
And then they used to overwinter and sprout. Here, it tends to be a little too cold, sometimes a little too wet. But you can plant them just as early as you can possibly get into that ground.
So as soon as you can work the soil.
As soon as you can work the soil, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
I think it's time to do a little work on individual. I brought in today some pictures of vegetables, and Sue has circled the ones that she thinks would be the really good ones. Now, you didn't circle onions.
No,
I'm an onion fan.
Okay, we can talk about
the
onions.
Don't leave me out in the cold.
Well, I circled green onions, I think.
Yes, you did. You did. Spring onions, they call them here, but green onions, yes,
yeah,
indeed.
Green onions, that's one of your really, really early things you can
sure.
put in. So that along with your arugula and your turnips.
Tolerates cool weather.
Tolerates the cool weather. My onions, I like to grow indoors to seedlings.
Okay.
And I usually plant them between March the 1st and March the 15th.
Wonderful. March the 1st to March the 15th, everybody. Get
yep.
your onion
yep.
seedlings
and,
lined up.
And you look at your if you don't have very much time, look at your onion packages or go onto the internet and look up your onions, and it will tell you the day lengths to maturity.
Indeed.
And you start planting your longest day length first. So for instance, your Walla Wallas are a very long day length to maturity. So I usually plant those first, and then I carry on with my other onions.
Now, you're raising an issue which I think is also important for all gardeners, and that is succession planting. And doing it, one way is to do it by just the same seeds but planted at intervals. But another one is what you're talking about now, which is choosing strains that are slow growing, planting them early, and then grow ones that grow faster, planting them a little bit later. Obviously, that's also plays into succession planting, in the sense that if you plant a slow growing and a fast growing at the same time, you'll have end up having a sort of a successional approach to what's ripening.
Absolutely, and this is where you either need to go onto the internet and check your seeds out and make sure you've got the right day length, or look on the back of the package. And some seeds will have on the back of the package the day length on them. And so what you can do is you can look at your carrots and you can see that this carrot is 72 days and this carrot is 84 days. Well, you could plant them both at the same time and you'll have succession planting.
Mm-hmm. The process of gardening, obviously, because of the fact that all plants do things a little bit differently, and we have to know which ones we're using. Why don't you just name a couple of, say, carrot strains or varieties that you really like, that you think would be good ones to grow around, or you know are good ones to grow around here, and have a little variability in their attributes?
Well, I've always grown open pollinated. There's a huge variety available now that are all hybrid seeds. And I have tended to grow open pollinated ones, mainly because I also was growing for seed as well as for crop.
Now, carrots are a food that everybody knows, but there's one plant, I remember this from my childhood, that is always the first out of the ground. It's sort of like a racehorse in full gear. And that's the radish. And there are a bunch of different kinds of radishes. Mm-hmm. But why don't you tell a little radish story?
Well, radishes are actually, they're very, very versatile. But again, when you go to your catalog, you'll see that some varieties, they say good for spring and fall. Other varieties can be grown all year.
You mean they will handle the heat of the summer?
They will handle the heat of the summer. And then you have your winter, what they call your winter radishes or your late radishes, that you don't plant until July. And those are your watermelon radish or your black Spanish radish or whatever. But radishes are a great way to get kids interested in the garden because you can buy something like an Easter egg blend or a sunshine blend. You know, the Easter egg are pink and purple and red and white. And the sunshine blend doesn't have any purple in it, but it has yellow ones.
Hmm.
So it's really, really...
It's a potpourri of color.
It's a potpourri of color, yeah, yeah.
Wonderful thing. Okay, beets. You do a circle around beets. Give us the beet story.
Well, beets is because it's one of those items that you can plant really, really early, and you can also grow them as a storage vegetable, and you can eat the greens. So for a small garden, they really have a big bang for their buck, let's put it that way. You can thin your beets and just eat those very miniature beets with the greens on them. You can put the beet greens in your salad, but don't take all the leaves, because the beet won't continue to grow without the nourishment.
So that's kind of like lettuce and arugula as well. You can trim it, sort of do a little haircut, but leave enough leaves for it to continue its journey.
That's actually quite different. You can take just about all the leaves off of the lettuce and the arugula, as long as you leave the growing tip.
Okay, that's good to know. I like arugula. I'm going to talk to my arugula plants when we leave here. So with beets, you're just trimming a few leaves off, because if you take more than a few, you would.
With beets, especially if you're putting them in your salad, you want the young tender leaves anyway. So what I tend to do is take the center circle of leaves out and use them in my salad.
And leave the peripheral.
Leave the tough old leaves on there, and make sure you don't take the growing tip out.
Sure.
And they'll just continue to grow.
Beets are extraordinarily good as storage crops. I've just been amazed. I've forgotten about beets in the fridge and come back and say, oh my goodness, that's about a month and a half old, and they look perfectly fine and they cook up very nicely. What vegetables store really well, and what's a basic way to store them?
Just in the home fridge, there's your carrots and parsnips, turnips, beets, probably kohlrabi, if you have some late kohlrabi, would store very well. Green and red cabbage stores well. Don't leave it in a plastic bag, because it will tend to rot. But if you leave it in something that will breathe, or even just in the crisper, you'll find the outer leaves might dry and look really tacky. But once you've cut those off, you've got a beautiful head that's been really well protected on the inside.
Right.
Don't store carrots in the same fridge that you are storing apples.
There's an argument shaping up between the apple and the carrot kingdom.
Yes. The apple gives off something called ethylene gas.
Indeed.
And the ethylene gas will turn your carrots bitter. So, yes.
They'll be resentful.
Yes, they will. Bitter.
Well, I've heard about ethylene gas from apples, that it is, sometimes they're picked a little unripe and they sort of ripen themselves or something like that.
Yeah, so apples, bananas, tomatoes, they all give off a gas. But
well,
with that, those are just the fridge vegetables.
Okay,
you can also store potatoes and squash and garlic and your favorite, the onion.
Yes, and they require sort of a coolish place that's fairly dry?
Cool, dry, fairly well ventilated, and they'll do really well there.
We once put some butternut squash in the garage, and it was still being used for the car. And in the winter, the snow melts off the wheel wells, and it was extraordinarily humid. We had the most glorious crop of fungus, multicolored, abundant. I took a picture. I sent it to some major publication around the world. Chilies.
Yes.
Chilies. Good thing to talk about on a cool day.
Yeah, sure. Hot peppers. Like, so many people really enjoy hot peppers these days.
Are they coming on more? Are people, you see them widely sold now, where at one point you couldn't find them in stores. It didn't seem to be, anyway.
There used to be a few scrawny jalapenos up in one corner type of thing. But now a lot of people are into the much hotter peppers and recognize that different peppers have different flavors.
Yes, indeed.
So it's really good. But if you want to grow a good hot pepper, you really need to start it early if you're going to start it yourself from seed. And
so early for the peppers would be what? February, March?
Into February and early March. And the other thing about peppers is they are actually a perennial.
Really?
Yes.
Year after year?
Yes. And not very often, but some people, because they get large and straggly and drop their leaves and don't look very attractive. But you can bring a pepper plant into the house and have it grow in the house.
And do you have to stake it? Does it sort of fall over if you don't prop it up?
Not if it has a reasonable amount of light. It doesn't. No, they're pretty.
And then you put it out the next year?
You can put it out again the next year.
And when perennial, I mean, technically it means forever, more or less. But what's sort of the lifespan of a pepper that you've sort of moved? Now, are you talking about hot peppers, not
hot,
sweet
hot
peppers?
Hot peppers in particular. Sweet peppers will do it as well. But the sweet peppers, they seem to grow quicker and they're easier to establish and get going. So a lot of people wouldn't really worry about them too much. But the hot peppers, you can actually leave them on the plant. If they dry on the plant, you can just pick them off and
put them straight into the soup.
Yes.
Okay, a good old English vegetable, the turnip. You know, all these jokes about falling off the turnip truck and that kind of thing.
There are so many kinds of turnips. And the white salad turnip, I don't know if you know that one.
I've seen it at the organic market.
Yep. They're absolutely delicious. The tops are also delicious. In fact, I prefer the tops to the bottoms. But they can be planted very early in the season. And they are very interesting to pests.
Oh, so they need to be protected.
They need to be protected. And there's two pests in particular in this area. One is the little flea, can't remember its name now. This is awful.
Not an aphid.
Flea beetle. The little flea beetle. Okay. And that will devour the leaves, or at least make lots of holes in them. Mm. And the other one is the root maggot, which is a fly. And it lays its eggs on the top of the turnip. And then the little maggoty things run down the turnip and start devouring the root, which causes a horrible problem, and you really don't want that.
And you pull the turnip up and it's mostly not there.
Exactly. So you can protect the salad turnips with Remay, which helps them.
Now, Remay is a sort of surface covering. Maybe just describe that a little bit. I'm sure a lot of listeners know about it, but just
okay. Remay is a lightweight cover that you can put over your early crops, which acts like a cold frame, and it holds the heat in. Some of them are good to 2 degrees. Some of them are good to a lot. The heavier ones are good to a lot more degrees. But I really like the lighter ones, that are 2 to 5 degrees, and because they don't crush the plant either. And you can just lay them down. You don't necessarily have to put hoops or you know, put a lot of work into it.
Float them on.
You can float them on. What you have to be careful of is that you hold the sides down, because you don't want the sides to lift and the bugs to get in underneath it, and that will protect from both the flea beetle and the root maggot
and the critters that go after brassica. I'm thinking for the cabbage loopers and those kinds of things, not just brassica, but other plants. I think Remay works for that, doesn't it?
It does work for that, but it sometimes is too hot.
Hmm.
So with that, you would use a product called ProtectNet, which doesn't hold the heat in.
My goodness. We're just getting started, Sue. We're going to have you back again. We are coming to the end of the show, and before we end, I wanted to just get a sense of what you see as the general direction that growing things, gardening, plant propagation is going as you observe it, because you're enmeshed in this world. Do you see some patterns emerging, some changes, some growth, if you like?
Well, I really hope so. I really hope that a lot of people are putting their own little vegetable gardens in. And you can grow a few vegetables in a pot on your patio. You can grow microgreens and other things in your house. And I just see that people are looking at their food budget and they're thinking, how can I bring my food budget down?
And Mother Nature is so generous with seeds and the means to grow. It's just lying there waiting for us to take up.
And a couple of large pots with some nice cucumbers and tomatoes and greens. And
I think our listeners are going to be hungry.
Yeah.
I can sense it. Sue, it's always a delight to have you in the studio. Thank you very much for coming in today, and we'll have you back again sometime.
That hour goes by so
quickly.
It
does, doesn't it? It's wonderful. Thanks so much.